four.
Oh shit, never mind.
Three, two, one.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Network with your hosts, Luke Cannon and Mr. 1000 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Welcome, everyone, once again to your daily anarchist show on the internet, the Authority Smashing Hour. Tonight, with your hosts, Joey and Mr. 1001 Nights. How you doing, Joey?
I'm doing great. Just wanted to send a shout-out to the listeners. Thanks for listening. And if you want to call in, 646-716-8106.
That's right. And if you want to post questions or comments on the chat room, feel welcome to do so. So I guess we can start out with some good news. The largest food non-bombs food share ever is going to take place on November 22nd. It's going to be in Long Island. And it says here, Long Island Food Non-Bombs is going to be putting on a half dozen events between November 21st to the 26th across Long Island. They're calling this a Thanksgiving bonanza. And one in a place called Hempstead, New York, is hoped, the 22nd, is hoped to be the largest vegan Thanksgiving food non-bombs ever. And they will be making 50 vegan entries, not including appetizers, soup, salads, desserts. So pretty good stuff, man. And they're sharing 10,000 pounds of Thanksgiving groceries, fresh produce, clothing, books, 2,000 pounds of vegan whipped cream to give out as well. And everyone is welcome, of course, except bosses and cops and stuff like that. But unless they want to give up their exploitative practices. But anyway, so that's
well,
good.
I think bosses and capitalists and people like that need to come to Food Not Bombs so that way they can see how how people can get together and do positive things via mutual aid.
Right. They so, usually
come on out.
they usually go there to kick people out, disrupt the event. But it's interesting because I discovered a few months ago about this girl who got killed in, I think it was New Orleans, and it was a girl from San Francisco, is where I live, and she was one of the organizers for the, I think it's called Really, Really Free Market, and it's like basically a sort of gift economy event every month at a place called Dolores Park here, where people go and you know, just share, you know, give out stuff for free, you know, and
sure.
So, pretty cool stuff, and so yeah, these events are a nice little, a step toward, meeting people and making it a better place. But we usually don't have such
definitely
good news.
I posted a link to a news article from InfoShop News about the big Food Not Bombs thing going on in New York. And also just a link to the Food Not Bombs organization itself in the chat room. What's your experience with Food Not Bombs there, Jonathan, I guess? In the Bay Area, I think they have pretty active chapters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they have chapters all over the world. In 2000 and, I think it was 2008 or 2007 that I went to the Anarchist Book Fair, and I interviewed one of the guys there, and he told me these guys seem like an angel, you know, the guy, you know, seemed like a totally super nice guy, and, you know, but he had been arrested, just for sharing food, just for going to place and sharing food. He has spent like 2 years in prison. I mean, it was just incredible. And it's a real crime, you know, if you try to, bring some solidarity and sharing and sort of, disrupt the pattern of exploitation. And, you know, since food is the most essential thing, you know, for life, and food is not free. That is, you know, especially good food. You go to the supermarket, you know, everybody knows that, if you go to some of the more fancy supermarkets, you know, I don't know about in your state, but here it's like you go to a place called Whole Foods or and I mean, this stuff is super expensive. I mean, it's like it's good, you know, it's nice food, but man, like you can spend a lot of money there. So, you know, anybody trying to do something different, it's going to be confronted because it's it stands out pretty radically.
Oh, definitely. I think Food Not Bombs has a pretty interesting history, which you can read about somewhere on that website that I posted in the chat room. It's foodnotbombs.net. But yeah, it's interesting how the powers that be respond to pretty much any sort of attempt at doing a free economy. We know about sort of the free market, quote unquote, but any attempts to like escape the logic of monetary exchange and that sort of stuff, and engage in actually free exchange of goods and production is very much a threat. And so, you'll see oftentimes Food Not Bombs get shut down. Not on any basis of like health concerns and that sort of stuff, but on the basis of the fact that they're sort of organizing, giving out food in quote unquote the wrong places.
I think they haven't
paid their fealty to the state and gotten the right, you know, vendor's license, even though they're not, you know, vendors.
I mean, I think we get back to the same issues that we usually discuss about. You know, the legal legitimization of practices that are much more unhealthy than anything Food Not Bombs does. So yesterday with David, we mentioned the film that came out, which I haven't seen yet. I saw the trailer. It's called Food Inc., I think. And it's a new film that talks about how people get fat and sick from the food that they buy in supermarkets. And since some of the healthier food is expensive, you know, you have all these people who eat all this garbage food, you know, hamburgers and all these sugary, you know, corn based products and stuff like that, and which are bad for you, and they're expensive in the long term because you end up, you know, destroying your body, having to go to the doctor, and that stuff is it's priceless. I mean, there's no price you can pay for your health, so and for your life. So that's that, you know, that's basically the legalized destruction of humans that is, you know, perfectly legitimate. But if you try to share food and bring about a different paradigm, that is unsanitary. That is considered to be bad. You know, so the double standards are so pervasive. And we just sort of internalize them. You know, we internalize that the assumption that the powers that be must be right because they... After all, they are in power, so they must be right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's one of these things. Like, it's so natural for us to share food when we're sort of in our intimate communities with our families, et cetera. But like, what's really sort of the threat is a sort of institution of that sort of mindset. Like that's what Food Not Bombs is. It can be a sort of institution of you know, the free sort of sharing and exchange of food. And that's where the real threat lies. Like, it's all, you know, well and good as long as it's sort of private, you know. But once it engages and draws in the public, then, you know, these types of things become a threat along the lines of what you were just talking about.
You know, one thing that I've experienced with a lot of these sort of more radical movements and ideas is that at first, if you've never encountered them, you know, you look at them and you think, well, these people are nuts, or, you know, they're not really. But then as you think about it, you know, you start expanding your sort of horizons of becoming aware of you know, all these things in society that affect us. Like yesterday, I was reading the works of Wilhelm Reich, you know, and he he talks a lot about sexuality, and I never really gave him a lot of credence. You know, I thought, you know, it's a bunch of crap. But now that I think about it, you know, I think that the sexual aspect of our society is very unhealthy. You know, especially after reading about, you know, hunter gatherers, how they interacted, their sexual lives and stuff. I mean, I usually, like in the first video collage that I did, I showed the Bushmen of the Kalahari, how they shared everything and stuff. But I didn't examine that. But I mean, just think about it, that you know, like 90% of the internet is porn, and you know, a lot of our sex lives are so, you know, and I'm sure that has also an effect, a psychic effect. And I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't want to say that Wilhelm Reich is right, but there's definitely an aspect of our lives that you know, people don't consider. So when you actually tell people, you know, first, well, do you think that a society where you don't have to rent yourself to a boss, or a society where, you know, maybe you don't have to you know, go through all these artificial sort of steps to get a sexual satisfaction, or I mean, all these different things that have become so natural and so normal, to get people to question those things, you know, that's a real challenge, because you know, we ourselves are still discovering some of these oppressive structures.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a process of, you know, bringing people to a different sort of point of view, perspective, et cetera. I mean, the issues, like, I'm not sure exactly what that author said. But I mean, you know, I remember seeing a documentary about, I don't remember exactly what it was, but a documentary about this guy, I think he was an anthropologist, who went out to the bush, you know, to do, you know, research on the bush people. And he was talking about how, like, they would just sort of, you know, freely have sex and all these other sorts of things, you know, and it's interesting, you know, that you bring up the bush video you did, because of course that wasn't an element of it. But I mean, you know, I think another thing that we have to keep in mind is to make sure that we're not going to sort of essentialize certain aspects of human behavior, including sexuality. So I think that, you know, different cultures, different societies are going to organize, you know, that sort of a relationship differently, you know.
Let me ask you a question.
And others, it's one of those things that, that's how those sort of cultures operate and societies operate. And
let me ask you, since you've studied a little bit of the medieval period, what were the sexual relations like in the medieval period?
Oh man,
have you looked at that at all? Or
oh yeah, we do a lot of stuff with that. The best way to sort of describe it is, I'd say, like, a mix between maybe our current most liberal Western notions and, like, Victorian notions of, like, prudery and all that sort of stuff. It was somewhere in the middle. Like, they were, like I said, I mean, different societies, cultures, time periods are going to have different standards for how to organize sexual relations, et cetera. You know, and they're going to be informed by whatever, you know, power relations are involved. But, I mean, by and large, the medieval period was probably a little more sort of sexually liberated than most people would give it credit for.
Right.
I think, you know, people being people, you know, everybody loves to have sex.
Right.
I can relate one story. Okay. One of my dissertation advisors, before he took off to, I think he went to some Ivy League school. But anyways, he gave a talk one time about, the shrine, to Saint Runyon I think this is somewhere in France. It was somewhere in France, and it's an amusing little place because people would go there to have their, because he was, the saint was like the patron saint of like urology, kidneys, you know, and sexual reproduction, etc. So people would go to this shrine on pilgrimage to have their sexual organs blessed. And
wow.
And how they would do this, oh yeah, and how they would do this is they would make actual casts, okay, of, like, the people's sexual organs. So there are actually, like, casts of, like, these medieval, and, like, there might be a handful of these things that survived, but there's, like, casts of, like, these medieval guys, you know, cocks, because they would go in, have them blessed, and then they make a cast out of it, most of the times out of wax. And so they even right. make like a votive candle. Oh, I'm dead serious. They make votive candles out of them, you know? And like, and so there'd be like that sort of thing. And the same, you know, with the female genitals and stuff. But the picture that is reported by travelers and pilgrimages of the shrine is that you walk in and there's basically like a bunch of dildos hanging around, like on all these little mini altars, et cetera. Because of all the people that went to have their genitals blessed.
Wow. Yeah, I mean it's an interesting,
I love that stuff. There's so much fun stuff going on, but yeah, it's different. I mean, you know, every place has its every place and time has a different sexual mores. I don't know how the hell did we get on this.
Well, it was me. It was me. No, I have been reading this Wilhelm Reich, who, I mean, he basically said that.
Right.
You know, because he was a Marxist, right? But he wanted to look at other, you know, I mean, Marx concentrated, of course, on you know, the workplace, the means of production, and Wilhelm Reich wanted to look at sexuality and I mean, but I think Marx himself said that the relations between men and women revealed an important aspect of our life, of our culture, of our level of alienation. So I mean, there's a lot there. I just think it's very complicated. I think
that's definitely true. I think that whatever, however sexual relations are organized, is going to reflect like other sort of fundamental issues involved with the power relationships of a society. I think that's a given. So yeah, I mean, you know, he's you know, right on. I think, anyways.
So yeah, well, that was an interesting topic. I guess we can we can go on to maybe discuss some of the other issues here.
Well, first, before we transition over, if anybody in the audience wants to call, the number again is 646-716-8106. 646-716-8106.
That's it.
And I mean, you know, we don't have to talk about, you know, medieval genital blackings or anything.
Well, a little bit of a tangent there. Anyway, so
there you have it. All right, what else we got there?
So we have some news on global warming, and world leaders says no binding deal on climate change until 2010. And I already sort of talked about this a little bit yesterday because there wasn't going to be any sort of legally binding treaty here, and it's all very weak. And the Copenhagen summit said that climate change talks have stalled as CO2 emissions rise. Says the Copenhagen summit on climate change is looking less likely to produce a binding CO2 emissions reduction agreement, as a new study finds that global carbon dioxide emissions increased 29% since 2000, so from 2000 to 2008. So I mean that's pretty substantial increase, and this is, I mean, we've known about global warming for a long time, you know, and I was telling David that all this discussion, and now I mean I just went to Borders and all of it plastered all over is Sarah Palin's new book, you know, and of course people like her deny global warming altogether. They say it doesn't exist, and so we're sort of confronted with a real threat to survival here, and it's going to be tough to, you know, to push that through if these big polluting countries can't even pass some, you know, laws to regulate the amount of CO2 they emit.
I do not know how the world, you know, is going to get mobilized or on board for like a global treaty for CO2 emissions. I don't know how practical it is to try to achieve something like a global treaty for CO2 emissions. I think it doesn't make much sense. And this brings in a whole bunch of other issues that I find problematic as well. Like, if the CO2 emissions, et cetera, are the cause, the culprit, which I sort of take scientific consensus for what it is, then I think that it's very difficult, even if everybody accepts that, to one, come up with a global treaty, and two, enforce the global treaty. I mean, I think of it much along the lines of like our silly nuclear proliferation treaties. It's like we have all these nuclear proliferation treaties. You know, you're not supposed to share nuclear weapons, blah blah blah, nuclear technology. It happens all the friggin' time, anyways. No, there's really nobody that can tangibly enforce it. So, you know, it's bizarre. Like, global warming's a problem. You know, but not global climate change. Let's say. Is an issue. Temperatures have been changing, et cetera, et cetera. But, our response to that, I don't know how practical it is to try to get some sort of global warming treaty and then, like, try to enforce it. Like, I don't understand how that's in any way, shape, or form.
Unless these governments are, pressured very strongly, they're just not going to do anything. This makes me think of something that I was looking at yesterday.
It's still an issue of, like, even if they do something, even if there is a treaty signed by the world, the question is it going to be enforced? Is it enforceable? Will it work to do what it says? I'm extremely dubious to that.
Right. Extremely. Right. There has to be a very strong regulatory apparatus, and otherwise it's not going to be enforced at all. You know,
go ahead.
I was looking at, just to change subject a little bit. I was reading this paper yesterday and about the problems of the world, and this was sort of it was a bit of a conspiracy theory, but it had at least a little bit of plausibility, but. I mean, I didn't really buy it, but I thought it was kind of interesting. It was this theory that said that it was about psychopaths and how this about the paper was saying this about 1% of the population that is psychopathic, that is people who have no conscience, and then there's about 5 to 6% of the population that are sort of partial psychopaths. I think they called them. I forget what the name, but they had a different name for them. And then they said they had about another 12% that although they were not psychopaths, they were sort of very corrupted by that sort of way of thinking. So they sort of became almost like psychopaths. So basically the theory said that these psychopaths actually had an easy time getting ahead in the system. Because of their ability to manipulate others, but you know, which sort of seemed plausible. But then I spoke to a friend of mine, and he told me that a lot of these psychopaths are actually not very—they're not very competent in many ways. Ascribe to these people some sort of supernatural power, superhuman power, where they can actually manipulate others and get into power. Because I mean, the theory also said that these psychopaths actually can recognize each other from youth, and then they can work together. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know if that's true, if these psychopaths actually can work together. But anyway, it was sort of a conspiracy theory, but I just thought it was kind of interesting. Have you heard about this theory at all?
Uh, I have not. It sounds like sounds like high comedy. I mean, I don't even know how you'd. First of all, I don't even know how you'd sort of define a psychopath. Second of all, I don't know how you'd you know, how you'd go around like measuring them, like measuring the amount of people that are psychopathic.
Right, right. I mean,
that measurement. Like, I want to know how one defines the term, and then how one sort of goes about quantifying the amount of people who are. Like, that just seems like more than bizarre.
And actually, I asked Chomsky about it. I asked Chomsky about it, and he said,
"Oh,
well,
really?
Yeah. And, you know, I was sort of interesting because I was interested because I thought, man, I hadn't heard of this before. I mean, I did hear that, you know, in the film The Corporation, you have Robert Hare, who's one of the outermost specialists on psychopathy, and he shows how the corporation has a lot of the traits of a psychopath. But I mean, I always assumed, and I mean, I still assume that it is simply mostly just human beings." You know, certain negative tendencies of our nature that are being magnified in an institutional setting, not psychopaths who actually get on to the top of the system. Although I don't doubt in some cases, if you have psychopathic tendencies, that you maybe do better in some circumstances. But the a psychopath is basically someone without a conscience, someone who can fuck you over and not have any regrets or anything like that. But yeah, you know, those numbers, I didn't see any evidence. You know, how do they know what percentage of the population is one thing or the other? That's, you know, I didn't see. And how do they know that they actually work together? I mean, that was very, very speculative. So,
well,
but anyway.
I simply don't know how you'd measure that. Like, what sort of behaviors, what responses would the person have to give to indicate that they're incapable of empathy? Like, what, like, I don't know. It just seems weird. It seems very,
Well,
I don't know. I'm dubious and stuff like that.
Right. I mean, I'm dubious. It's an interesting sort of theory. I mean, because what basically what it says is that psychopaths, you know, and I have to, and sort of, you know, that they modify their own behavior. They put on a mask, you know, and they're able to act a certain way, to fool others, and in fact they're extremely convincing. That's what they're saying, that they're extremely convincing, and they can fake emotions and all those things. And you know, it's just I think Chomsky would say, someone like him would say that, you know, it's so complicated in our society to understand even one human being and understand the complexities of our character that to speculate on such a broad basis is a little bit it's not really supported by evidence at all. I mean, I think certain things we can say.
I basically agree with that sort of thing. I mean, I guess we can come to some sort of agreement, definition, on, in the abstract, what a psychopath is. I mean, you can look up in the dictionary, blah blah blah, kind of tell you what exactly, definition-wise, it is. But when it gets to like each individual person, how are you going to figure out how to define how that person fits into that definition? It's just way too complicated. And then, you know, and then the issue is like, you know, what real sort of purpose does this serve? Now, the study about corporations acting in a psychopathic manner, I mean, they're just going on an abstract level. I mean, they're not talking about like polling X amount of people and figuring out that, you know, 1% is full on psychopath, 5% are partial psychopaths,
right,
you know,
right.
Up to 20. Yeah. I don't know. I'm, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that the an institutional setting where you, I mean, it's so easy to see it even in ourselves, that, you know, people who are not psychopaths, people who are have a conscience, people who are perfectly morally sound, they can function,
yeah,
in institutions.
But how do we define even that? Like, how do we define moral soundness?
Well,
that's what I'm saying. I mean, we get into like very bizarre and weird,
well,
like centralizing territory.
I think,
at some point along the line.
I don't know. I mean, I see. It's true that there's a gray area, but I mean, for example, the Eskimos, who, by the way, had a pretty anarchistic system, you
Right.
know. They said that they had a name for psychopaths, which was the I forget what it was, the person who knows what to do but doesn't do it, or something like that. And basically, they actually ended up killing these individuals. They basically they say that, you know, that they ended up throwing them from a cliff or something. But I mean, that's the I think that it's hard to tell also because you know, psychopaths can actually you know, have a sort of a mask, a creative personality that they have mastered pretty you know, and they can, you know, they can fool people. And but then again, you know, I think most of us are, because of the psychopathic structures in which we live, like, you know, corporate structures, alienated relationships of production, alienated to sexuality to some extent with a lot of people. You know, we have all these alienated circumstances which do create antisocial behavior. And so once again,
Right.
you know, high that's why I thought this was interesting, but I think we should stick with institutional analysis. So, you know, how do the institutions affect our behavior,
Well,
and to what?
that's what you're talking about right now. Yeah, that's what you're talking about right now. That's what matters. That's the sort of thing that we can work on in a more tangible type of way, in the institutional angle. Like, I think when we get into you know, trying to set up formula for how to measure whether or not someone's a psychopath, you know, et cetera, going all the way down the line. I don't know. It just seems like, you know, walking down the wrong sort of path as far as like the sort of changes and outlooks we want to facilitate. Like, it just doesn't make much sense to me
By the way,
in the abstract.
someone just sent me a book. Someone on YouTube who is a writer here. His name is T.A. Sedlak, and he said, "I'm going to send you the book that I just wrote." And I said, "Okay, fine." And he just did, and it's called "Anarcho Grow," "Pura Vida in Costa Rica," and apparently some sort of a novel or something. So I'll have to read it, but. Well, it looks interesting. anyway, but yeah. So, is there any news item or any subject that you want to talk about, or?
Well, why don't we go ahead and we're about halfway through, so let's go ahead and take a break
Oh yeah. Let's
and
take a break. Play a song, and I remind everyone: if you
and
want to call in when we get back, the number is 646-716-8106. So we're going to play a song, and we'll be back in a few minutes. And I guess we can play. Let me see. I think David uploaded some new songs. So let's
why don't
play.
we play Jesus with the Communists? We didn't get to finish that song yesterday.
Right. Well, let me look for it then. Jesus was a con. You know, I like that song. Who sings that song, by the way? Here it is.
I think that's the Reagan Youth.
Reagan
Yeah,
Youth, that right here.
the
Yes. All
solo.
right.
Thank you.
All right, Jesus Was a Communist by Reagan Youth. And I didn't know much about this band. Are they libertarian socialist, or what are they?
I don't know. I think the song is good.
He's just a communist. Yeah, that's fun. That's fun. So, anyway, so, well, not so fun is the fact that there's a new government report explaining how a quarter of all U.S. children went hungry last year. Says new government data shows nearly 50 million Americans, including a quarter of all children, struggled to get enough to eat last year. The Department of Agriculture found that nearly 17 million children lived in households in which food at times was scarce last year, 4 million children more than the year before. The government data startled even anti-poverty advocates. So, you know, pretty harsh stuff, man. And on other news, the percentage of delinquent mortgages has reached a new high. In other economic news, the housing crisis appears to be worsening. The overall delinquency rate for home mortgages has reached a new high. Over 6% of all mortgage loans were 60 or more days past due during the third quarter. In Nevada, the delinquency rate reached 14.5%. In California, the rate has stopped 10%. So yeah, more economic troubles, and Bernanke apparently has said that, you know, this is gonna be basically what Thomas Ferguson told me back in March when I interviewed him. You know, he said there's gonna be a jobless recovery, because the capitalists don't want to have a recovery based on increased employment. It's just not to their advantage. The financial sector doesn't give a damn about that, and you know, they are gonna be shielded by the government since they have control. So it's just amazing. And there's just no sight of an end to the crisis.
I think it's massively a sort of it's just a convoluted mess at this point. I don't even know how you begin to untangle everything. I just put a link in the chat room. I guess we could deal with them sort of one at a time. About a quarter of the kids in the U.S. Going hungry last year. There is a new documentary coming out called The End of Poverty. And it's a play on a book by, let me find it here, by some neoliberal economist. About how neoliberal economics is going to sort of save the world from poverty, et cetera. So it's a response to these types of ideas, but that's been going on for
a long time. Right, and I mean, yeah, the apologists have always been saying, "Hey, corporate globalization is good for the world. It's good for poverty." I mean, people like Johan Norberg, who back in 2003, I think, wrote "In Defense of Global Capitalism." I mean, all these people, you know, from these think tanks, that's what they've been saying all along.
Yeah, I think it was Sachs, Jeffrey Sachs, who wrote the book called The End of Poverty. But this new documentary coming out is basically interrogating that idea, the entire idea that that neoliberalism and that sort of stuff will usher us out of poverty. It's got limited screenings, I think, in pretty much all the big cities. So it'll be on like New York, Boston, out in the Bay Area, LA, Chicago, like those type of places. But it was pretty well regarded at some of the film festivals and stuff, like Cannes, et cetera. So I put the link on the chat room. It's the website's www.theendofpoverty.com, and that speaks a bit to sort of how the powers that be have viewed their their economic system as bringing about the end of poverty. And actually, the documentary goes about to show that actually it produces poverty, produces economic deprivation, et cetera. You know, I mean, it's really no surprise that eventually these types of policies are going to come home to roost in the epicenter of global capital, which is the U.S. So I guess in lots of ways, the way the economy is set up and negotiated by and facilitated by the U.S., it's only a matter of time before these things sort of come home to roost, so to speak. And so here we have, like, you know, a quarter of children in the U.S., you know, going hungry. It's, you know, it's not surprising given the rest of the economic situation, the crisis, you know, which of course is a typical feature of capitalism itself. Like, there's constant crises that capitalism has to solve. And then after solving it, invents it, you know, invents a new crisis, et cetera. We've seen this go on since, you know, 16th century tulips, you know. It's not, right. It's not anything, you know, fundamentally different. So, but yeah, and insofar as the delinquent mortgages is concerned, it's really an interesting situation because here you have a bunch of people who thought they would be able to get their little piece of the American dream. Unfortunately, that piece of American dream was bought with a phantom credit. So, you know, it's one of these things where it's like we're sort of sold, quote unquote, sold, you know, a vision of how we should live our lives, and everybody sort of strives to get that. And you know, the economic system then turns around and you know, bites these people in the ass. In lots of ways, you know, it's lots of these people's sort of own doing, I'd say, as far as the mortgage delinquency. But then again, our choices are extremely limited.
Well, I mean, we have a society that fosters consumerism. And that's and
exactly.
You know, a few shows ago I spoke about how in the UK there was a study showing an incredible increase among theft of luxury articles, you know, meats, among a middle class and middle upper class people who were not doing so well, and they didn't want to give up their lifestyle, you see, of eating all this fancy stuff. So the amount of theft was, you know, had gone up incredibly. But talking about the American,
I for one love that. I find that to be like wonderfully subversive and indicative of like people's potential for revolution. I mean, here these people are going out to steal the stuff they think they need and deserve. I mean, that doesn't.
Well, I mean, yeah, but of course the upshot.
That immensely amusing.
Yeah, the upshot of the whole thing is that even though, you know, on the one hand it does reveal, you know, some rebelliousness, on the other hand it I think reveals a sort of a sick aspect of our society that you are what you have, you know, and like, so if you stop eating all these fancy meats and getting all these fancy items, then somehow your status has been lowered. So their lowering of status is basically what's motivating them to do this, not so much any revolutionary aspirations, unfortunately. But it does show the potential to do this, but, you know.
Yeah, just speaking specifically to that really quickly, the Invisible Committee in the Coming Insurrection speaks directly to that point of everybody's sort of identity being related to what they have, rather than, you know, sort of who they are, et cetera. So that's something that, you know, lots of people are giving a lot of thought to lately. I'm heartily amused by consumerism coming around to bite the capitalist scum that created the consumer culture right in the ass. So
right,
that, I mean, that I find, you know, very
this goes back to, I mean, Eric Fromm wrote this
book. Oh, by the way, before we keep going, we're about like 15 minutes till the end of the show. Again, the number 646-716-8106, 646-716-8106. If anybody wants to come in, introduce something else, talk about other things we talked about, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
No, I was talking about that. You know, I've mentioned before Eric Fromm's book "To Have or to Be," and he talks about that basically drawing from Marx, because Marx spoke about. I think in one of his books, Marx said that the more you the more the economist gives you in terms of wealth in our economy, the less you are, like, you know, in our society. Okay, well, you know, like, you want to go out and have fun, or you want to go out and say, you know, get a car to attract women, or you want to get, you know, all these things. They require money, and they add to your success as a person, and they add to your personality. On the other hand, if you don't spend, you're saving, right? You're depriving yourself from all these things that give you what we call a good life. So Marx said, you know, the more you have, you know, the more money you're saving, the less you are, you know, and the more you become alienated, and it's, you know, if you look at some of the more healthier societies, like hunter-gatherer societies, they don't have that dynamic where you know you're alienating yourself by saving money or not doing things that you want to do and stuff like that. I mean, that doesn't have the impact that it has in our society. So I think that's an important insight. You know, the material aspect
and Marx's notions of alienation are extremely useful in lots of ways. I don't know that we're going to be able to, you know, elaborate them to any justification that I feel they deserve in the next 13 minutes.
Right. I mean, it's.
But yeah, it is an interesting point, and Marx does speak to this issue, as do, you know, lots of the later Marxists, even post-Marxists, speak to how alienation sort of affects society, and by alienation we mean sort of, you know, the Marxist notion of capitalist alienation. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that well, like for instance, I was watching Glenn Beck today at 5 o'clock, as per my usual ritual, making dinner for the kids, etc. I watched Glenn Beck, like, you know, middle class bourgeois housewives watch Oprah. But anyway, so I'm watching Glenn Beck, and, you know, he's doing his usual ranting and raving and other nonsense about, you know, how the economy is going to hell in a handbasket because, you know, Obama is a socialist, and, you know, the Fed is, yeah, that's what it was. Today he was, like, starting in with, like, the Fed is, you know, screwing us all over and inflating our money and this and that and whatever. But the whole thrust, okay, of his argument revolved around people taking personal responsibility, okay, for their economic lives, which, okay, it is what it is. That's, you know, that's a valid mode of argumentation. So anyways, he wants people to take sort of personal responsibility, all right, and he wants a sort of, you know, more austere consumer, okay, someone who lives within their means, okay, as he says. And so, but what's amazing, what is utterly and completely amazing, is the fact that he doesn't make any connection whatsoever, not to sort of Marxist theories of alienation, but simpler stuff. He doesn't make any connection to the fact that the reason why people live off of credit, okay, the reason why people don't, quote-unquote, live within their means, especially in the U.S., which is basically a petty bourgeois society, is precisely because our wages have stagnated, okay, over the last 30-some-odd years. And so, you know, he puts the blame, all right, in the hands of the government, and he puts the blame in the hands of, like, these individuals, okay, who are just playing the consumer's game. He doesn't even think to put the blame where it really and fundamentally lies, and that is with the capitalist system itself, especially in its late global incarnation after the 70s. The reason why people live on credit is because everybody hopes and expects the standard of living stays the same or grows, etc. But the problem is that to have a society where standard of living increases, okay, we need our wages and our ability to purchase things to increase in
concomitant. Right, and that has gone down. Anyway, Joey,
and that has gone down.
We have a caller on the line.
Okay, so. Yes. Yeah, that's great.
Hello? This is, is this Chris?
Oh, hold on here.
Hi.
I got something in my throat.
Okay, are you all right, man?
Pardon me. Reason I'm calling is
Has
to do with the strange justice of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And it's kind of an unusual situation where he is the alleged mastermind of all the 9/11 terror and so forth. So we now have the situation where Holder wants to prosecute him in New York City. And that doesn't make a lot of sense, because any attorney is going to say, well, this is the most prejudiced part of the whole United States, and I want to change the venue. And I'm just wondering, what does this say about the supposed equality of justice in the United States? The president himself said that he expected Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to have to face the full measure of justice, which is not saying that he was expected to have a fair trial. He was expected to be guilty, in other words, which is what the president himself has implied.
Uh-huh.
So, I guess the United States, pardon me, after World War II, we stood up for justice. We gave the Nazis fair trials, and they certainly did more to us than a few people in airplanes did. I mean, 9/11 was not a picnic. Those people shouldn't have died. But there are so many irregularities about the standard story, the government story anyway, that I think we need a full investigation by an objective commission to find out what's really going on here. Explosives were found by scientists in a peer-reviewed paper online, and that's not a small thing. That's not part of the standard story at all. So, you know, maybe Mohammed was part of it, maybe he planned something, but there certainly are other dimensions to this that we don't know.
I guess that one of... One of the things that I would say is that a lot of people in the United States confuse justice with retaliation, vengeance. And in many people's eyes, that's certainly a very important part of justice to retaliate.
There was an article in the Wall Street Journal where some professor of law actually said that in Afghanistan, revenge was a very valid activity for us to pursue there. And I thought that's a fairly bloodthirsty thing for a professor of law to say, but he said that we deserve to do this, that humans have done this throughout their existence, and it's very valid and so forth, and, legitimate pursuit of vengeance for terrible injustice. And the problem was that he did not seem to include the 1 million people that we killed in Iraq. He said the scales were weighted in favor of the perpetrators. I say that we killed so many people that any scale would certainly be already vastly in favor of what we've done, you know, against us. So I'm just saying, what has America turned into when we go back to World War II and we find out that we will allow the Nazi henchmen of Hitler to actually... Some of them got off, and the rest of them were imprisoned, and most of them got out early. Only one of them died in Spandau. I think that was Hess. He was there for, like, the rest of his life, but the rest of them got out.
Hey, Joey, you want to respond to that?
I think your comparison to Nuremberg is interesting, because I don't necessarily see quite as close. Well, I don't see quite as distant a connection between the two. Here's why. Because when the Nuremberg trial started, okay, the laws for which the Nazis, the international laws for which the Nazis were supposedly up on, you know, were created after they had violated them. Now, I'm not defending them in any way, shape, or form. I just want to make that completely clear. But so, like, the idea that, you know, the Nuremberg trials were somehow more just than what is sort of being engineered is basically a puppet trial in New York, which I think you're exactly correct about, is not quite accurate, at least, you know, from my reading of things. Because I totally agree. I didn't catch your name. Who is this?
Chris. Well,
Chris.
I disagree with you, Joey. I do think that the Nazis did get. I mean, of course, LeMay said that if they had lost the war, they would have been condemned as war criminals. But as far as the crimes they committed, I think that some of the Nazis actually got off, which I'm saying in the current environment, if somebody from, say, the Taliban was accused of a similar crime, they would not give him that sort of chance to escape punishment.
Well, I mean, we don't necessarily know that. I mean, that process we have to sort of see unfold. What I'm saying is that on a more sort of structural, fundamental, legal level, the puppet trials, they were puppet trials in Nuremberg, are every bit as much as puppet trials as they are here now.
I mean,
the whole idea that they're going to take KSM and put him on trial in New York because now they've got enough evidence to make sure they can convict him. You know, that. So they're assuming already that he is guilty. Like, they wouldn't have. Holder said, oh, we wouldn't have brought him to trial if we didn't think we could win. You hear that all the time, actually, in justice circles.
Well, think of it this way.
Yeah.
We didn't torture the Nazis. And colleague Sheikh Mohammed was tortured, so his confession that he has may be completely invalid.
Oh, sure. But ideally, once you get in court, that sort of thing, any sort of confession, okay, elicited by torture in a U.S. civil court, or U.S. criminal court, sorry, is going to be inadmissible regardless. And on top of that, what's also interesting about it, and I'm not defending the trials or whatever, but what's also interesting about it is the fact that if it comes out that he was tortured and it is inadmissible,
he was tortured. He was waterboarded.
In the legal, system. Within the legal system, okay? But then we'd have, like, you know, actually sort of, the torture itself would then be on trial.
We have another caller, so maybe we can take it before the end of the show.
But
thank you very much for calling, Chris. Hopefully you can call again some other time.
Again, it's an interesting discussion, and there are different viewpoints, even within our side, but yeah.
90 seconds.
I think it's actually we only have 1 minute for the end of the show, but guess... We can't take that. Well, we can let the caller say something. Caller, we only have about a minute left. You want to say something?
Yeah, you guys rock.
Is this David?
Yeah, this is David. Good to hear, man. What's up?
I figured it was you.
Yeah, well, we're having a meeting, right?
Right, at the end of the show.
Second.
Well, I want to thank everyone for listening to the show, and... I guess since we're going to have a little meeting here, talk about the show, we're not going to play a song. Or actually, we can play a song, and then I'll stop it when we start the meeting. So this is Bob Marley, Burning and Lootin'.